With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Issues that impact you are the same issues that impact Damian Richardson on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Every now and then you get a phone call from a friend, a colleague I used to work with for quite a while during the height of the restrictions in the pandemic, Michael Gray Griffiths from Cafe Lockdown. He's still out in the community, still traversing this very wide brown land of ours, getting responses from Australians to this rapidly changing world in which we live in. There's no doubt, just talking to people about it, you can see that. And he was in Ballarat and he was ringing me up. Sometimes he rings me up just a little bit distressed with what he would call the carnage, or what he's dealing with, seeing people trying to respond to institutions. He's out the front of ABC Ballarat. He's got the Forest of the Fallen up. We talked to the girls that have been promoting the Forest of the Fallen a couple of weeks ago, or maybe even a month ago now. But the Forest of the Fallen is this installation with on stakes with the names of people that have either died as a result of the vaccination or have been injured in some respect. And they put this forest up and people come and respond to it and talk about it, et cetera. And anyway, they put it up out the front of ABC Ballarat. Now, you could consider that to be slightly antagonistic, but why not? It's just a solemn event. There's no protesters whatsoever. It's just a forest of fall, and there might only be a couple of people standing around overseeing it. And obviously the employees were going into the ABC, walking past this forest with boldly proclaiming the people that had been sick and injured or indeed had passed away. Undeniably so, more and more, you know, talked to Dr. Melissa McCann yesterday about a class action where 500 Australians have got the opportunity, well, I think, and counting, with three Australians at the helm, to bring a class action on behalf of those people who have been denied, have been disparaged as anti-vaxxers and neo-Nazis, etc., all the rest of the epithets that have been thrown at us. And so Michael was simply saying to some of the ABC employees gainfully employed at the taxpayers' expense, I saw recently they got an increase to their wages, quite generous increase to their wages too, despite the fact that ABC Radio ratings have absolutely plummeted. So people aren't necessarily tuning in anymore. But would this make them pivot? Even in light of the Pfizer documents being released that showed that the company itself knew within 2 months that there was no efficacy to these vaccines, not as they were promoting it, but it was too late. The promotion was already in. It was already in train, and there was no pulling it up. There was no arresting it. I'm not saying anyone even had the intent or the will to want to arrest it. But people have been coming out and talking about the Pfizer documents. It's unmistakable that the ABC must be aware of the reality that the nature of the conversation is changing. I know there's been there's been articles in some of the Murdoch papers, dare I say it, have been pulling back on the vitriol as far as people that chose not to be part of the vaccination process are concerned, and even showing some empathy for those people that were casualties, having accepted the vaccination process, but not at the good burgers at ABC Ballarat. They won't accept that there is a changing in the narrative. And they've denied talking to people about it. You can't even get a voice heard in it. And I saw Michael was talking and said, well, we can understand why that would be the case with, the commercial networks, 9, 7, 10. But the reality is it's the case too with the state, and the state and the corporations have fused into a corporatocracy, and you can see it when you you come in conflict with it, and its denial of your rights as it continues to spruik, wanting to bring diversity, cultural diversity and inclusion to every aspect of the culture. And matter of fact, let's spread it throughout the world too, where CEOs of international banking institutions on obscene levels of money will talk about wanting to have programs that include those people that traditionally may not have been able to have a loan at a bank. And you think, this is just too much. It's too much to be real, and it's hard to take it, and it's hard to listen to it. And it's ultimately an attack on the middle class, an attack on those hardworking mums and dads that are expected to continue to pay their taxes to support a regime, support the employees at institutions like the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that refuse to take account, despite its charter, to take account of both sides of the argument. Why? Why? And it makes one very skeptical of their agenda. It makes one end up being in conspiratorial rabbit holes, because it seems to me so much of the conspiracies turn out to be the truth, turn out to be the case, and turn out still not to be reported in the mainstream. And that's why we're offering you this service, of course, on TNT Radio. So, why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all the major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. So help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time, unafraid, on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Getting straight to the facts.
Enough with the lies. We need facts.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Now, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has sparked backlash over his response to a controversial question posed by English journalist Piers Morgan. Oh, my God, I think I know what this question is. TNT Radio News producer Jeremy Beck has details on this story. Jeremy.
Hi, Damien. I'll just keep you in suspense just a little bit longer about that question. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese featured in what Piers Morgan described as an extraordinary exclusive interview, which aired at 8 p.m. on Tuesday night UK time. Now, what was that controversial question? What is a woman? What is a woman, Prime Minister? Asked Piers Morgan. Now, Mr. Albanese replied instantly, an adult female. Woohoo!
Boom.
It's incredible.
Hang on.
In response, Piers Morgan proceeded to question, how difficult was that to answer? Not too hard, Mr. Albanese says, and adds, I was asked that during the election campaign, actually. And he continued telling Morgan that he respected people for whom they were. Our Prime Minister's response quickly led to intense debate online, what do you expect, with some accusing him of not even acknowledging transgender women in his statement. We had trans activist and blogger Eleanor Evans says Mr. Albanese used the question as an opportunity to drop anti-trans dog whistles while umming and ahhing about respect. All through this, he couldn't even bring himself to say the word trans, she tweeted. And then we have Guardian Australia's political reporter, Amy Remikus, accused the PM of legitimising a hateful question. I don't think it's a hateful question, Damien, but what would I know?
What would you know, indeed? You're an old dinosaur like me, I reckon, Jeremy. Now, and clearly, like the Prime Minister, Mr. Albanese. It's easy for Albanese to do this. He's been schooled, hasn't he? He saw what happened to his colleague over the ditch, New Zealand Prime Minister Chris Hipkins, who couldn't answer that question. So I'm sure his minders were with him, you know, for 5-10 minutes saying, what's a woman? No, just answer. Come on. What's a woman? What's a woman? Rehearse me again. Ask me again. What's a woman? Yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready. It's a grown adult female. What? No, yeah, that'll do. Just leave it. Jeremy, this backlash to our Prime Minister, no one cares. Do people really care about this? It's just these people that want their 15 minutes of fame that you've talked about already that know they can jump in the sunlight, you know? Just for a moment, in the spotlight, I should say. Certainly not in the sunlight. They're in the shadows, but the spotlight to some extent. Jeremy.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head, Damien. Who cares? I mean, look, this issue has been drummed up by these noisy trans activists, Most people just want to get along with their lives. Most people are worried about inflation, are worried about all sorts of issues that are affecting them personally. How are they going to pay their mortgage with the interest rates going up, all sorts of issues that are much more important to people, or concerned about the real threat of war. I mean, look at the escalation of the war in Ukraine that we should not be involved in, all sorts of things like that, the threat of increasing tensions between the United States and China. The last thing Australia would need is a conflict over Taiwan. So many bigger issues, most people simply don't care.
Yeah, so I mean, has Anthony Albanese joined the ranks of the likes of us? Is he now an anti-vaxxer as well, and God forbid, a neo-fascist? And do you think he's played, you know, a straight back and smart, straight bat and smart politics on this?
I think he's played smart politics here, Damien. But nonetheless, he sounded all the same a little bit awkward. If you listen to the interview, he sounded a little bit awkward. This is sort of unfamiliar territory for him, I think. But it was quite good to hear all the same. I think he just knows the mood of the Australian people. He just couldn't get away with pushing this radical trans line. And when it came to the question of trans athletes. Competing with women, he skillfully dodged that. They will just leave it to the sporting authorities, so he wasn't going to take sides there. I think it was smart politics, which is pretty rare there for our Prime Minister, I think.
But no leadership. Smart politics, but no leadership. Jeremy Beck, news producer, thanks so much for that story. You are listening to TNT Radio.
Politically Incorrect on TNT Radio.
You're not enamoured with the review that's just been pushed onto the Australian public by our political elite.
Nowhere in there does it actually mention who we're actually designing a brand new army to actually defend us against. It's the, what is it, from Harry Potter, the Voldemort, the name that cannot be said. Even in 1936, Winston Churchill had the courage to say that Germany is going to be the enemy. Now, we are not allowed to say that, so I don't know who we're supposed to actually suspect that the enemy might be. Maybe we don't have any enemies now.
Everyone loves us?
Everyone loves us. And we never mentioned Taiwan, because obviously we're afraid to get anywhere close to Taiwan, because that would cause a response from the name that cannot be said. So anyway.
I'm not allowed to mention who. Are we having a guessing competition?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Weekends are better when you spend it with Mike Tennessee and Richard Carson on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
You're invited to join the pilgrimage to Bath, United Kingdom this June, where we will unveil a better way for health, freedom, and sovereignty. The Better Way Conference is a three-day solutions-based conference with more than 50 expert speakers from around the world. Our Master of Ceremonies, Neil Oliver, will take us on a journey through eight inspiring conversations, addressing the issues that matter most to individuals and families around the world right now. Hear from speakers like Dr. Pierre Corey, Matthias Desmet, Dr. Vandana Shiva, and other leading international minds as we continue to co-create a better way forward. Panel hosts include James Corbett of The Corbett Report, Richard Vobes, The Bald Explorer, and the New Americans, Veronica Karolinko, and many more. Wherever you are in the world, you can join us in person or online for less than £40 or $50 for the full program. Get your full conference, single day, or virtual passes now at betterwayconference.org. Please join, share, and collaborate with us as we create a better way for a better world.
Plug in.
Website.
TNTradio.live.
Check it out.
Today's News Talk Radio.
It's the coolest.
TNT.
Now, just over a month ago, and as a matter of fact, on March the 10th, to be precise, it was reported that Silicon Valley Bank, the 16th largest bank in the US market, perhaps due to its woke lending practices, had collapsed, leaving, you know, international money markets in disarray. They all came back together again, miraculously came back together again. We're all just going along nicely, but apparently not, because now the 14th largest bank in the US economy has also collapsed. That's the First Republic Bank, and it's all bets are off again. It's been taken over by the biggest banking organization in the US, JP Morgan, making it even bigger again. I wonder if that's a problem too to the market. Anyway, My next guest is going to talk about that. It's Martin North. He's the principal of Digital Finance Analytics, which combines primary consumer research, industry modeling, economic analysis and segmentation analytics to offer insight into the dynamics of the mortgage lending, savings, payments and superannuation industries. Martin, welcome back to the show.
Hey. Hello.
Hello. Where are we, Martin? Hello. What's happened? What are we facing now in the US?
Well, just bear in mind that there are many hundreds of regional banks in the US. It's a very different structure to Australia. And nobody quite knows how deep the crisis actually is among these regional banks. The reason is that about two or three years ago, the regulatory framework that drove banking in the US after the global financial crisis was tuned down to allow these regional banks more flexibility and freedom. So the regulatory framework that controls the biggest banks, the banks that are too big to fail, doesn't necessarily apply to a number of these smaller banks. So we've had three now. You know, the First Republic was probably the second biggest bank failure in the US. But nobody quite knows whether this is really the end. Of course, the big players want to say, nothing to see here, everything's fine. But if you understand that the reason this went wrong was because of the massive swing in interest rates from ultra-low levels to the Fed's current cash rate and probably more to come, you've got to ask the question, how deep is this problem and what are the implications more broadly?
You talk about interest rates, but it was also everyone talked about at the time, once Silicon Valley Bank collapsed, that there would be panic in the market and they're really scared that depositors would go to banks, especially these regional banks you talk about in the US, and withdraw their funds. And ultimately, that's what's happened, isn't it, to First Republic? Like it's had a run on its funds and it saw like it lost $101 billion in savings that people had in that bank. So that's also part of the problem, isn't it?
Well, yeah, banking is about confidence. And, you know, if you've got money in the bank and you start hearing rumors about the bank being potentially under pressure, the first thing you're going to do is take your savings elsewhere. And of course, these days with online and, you know, digital, you can move money much more quickly than previously. So the amount of money that was draining out of that particular bank was a record level, and it happened very quickly. And, you know, there are certain assumptions that the regulators make about how quickly deposits could be withdrawn, and they broke all the records. So people just, you know, heard about it and acted. And why wouldn't you? You know, if you've got money in a bank and you hear rumors, then you go somewhere else. That's why, of course, you know, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury and, you know, everybody else in the US is saying, no, everything's fine. The banking system is perfectly fine. It's perfectly fine as it isn't.
They'd never say otherwise, though. They're ideologically predisposed to have to say everything's okay. Mm.
They can't. They can't say it's a problem. And interestingly, the Fed did a review of SVB and the other failure, and they concluded that the regulatory system wasn't actually adequate, and they made some recommendations to tighten it up. So there is a tacit recognition that the regulatory processes that should have protected the banking system were insufficient to do it. And that wasn't majorly reported, but to me that's very significant, because what it means is we don't know how many of those other hundreds of banks in the US are potentially facing somewhat similar issues. You know, it may not be as aggressive or as difficult as First Republic, but the fact is nobody quite knows. And the point about these regional banks is they are a huge element within the overall financial system in the US. So there, a lot of these are in a particular geographic area, or they service particular types of customers, but they do a lot of meat and potato type banking. And so that the question then becomes is, well, if more of these banks get into difficulty, are the very large banks just going to hoover them up? And what does that do then to the structure of the financial system in the US? Does it actually become more and more concentrated, and do we become more hostage to banks who are effectively too big to fail? And I have a feeling, if you look at the analysis of relative bank valuations, small banks are being valued much more weakly than strong banks, because strong banks are perceived to be too big to fail. In other words, they can't possibly fall over, the government will rescue them. Small banks, not so much.
But we saw before, didn't we, with Silicon Valley Bank collapse a couple of months ago, that that had huge consequences even for some of the big players. So Credit Suisse had to be bailed out by its own government to the tune of $120.5 billion US dollars. So this has an exacerbating effect throughout the whole of the industry, doesn't it, or in international markets?
Well, it does. There's 2 points. The first is that if you were actually JP Morgan, you wouldn't want to buy this bank until it had failed. So in fact, the First Republic effectively was pulled into bankruptcy by the FDIC, which is the regulatory organization. That reduced the price that JP Morgan actually had to pay, firstly. Secondly, the FDIC has entered into a loss sharing agreement with JP Morgan, so that the FDIC has agreed to about 80% of the credit losses on First Republic's mortgages and commercial loans. So the government is indirectly guaranteeing what JP Morgan has done. So the remarkable thing is that essentially the deal was very favorable to JP Morgan. So from a financial engineering perspective, they've done very well. But the net result is the government is still on the hook for some of this.
Yeah, and the regulatory authority is the arbiter of who actually can take over the First Republic Bank. So they're not an impartial regulatory authority at all. They're actually an active player in it. How does that work?
Well, they are actually, and of course, they call the shots. So they invited a number of large players to bid, and they chose JP Morgan. And now, of course, JP Morgan only had the weekend to review what was going on inside First Republic, which is one of the reasons why this agreement is in place. But it's interesting that First Republic's loans had famously good credit quality. They actually got into trouble in the first place by making low interest mortgages to very rich people who will probably pay back those loans in due course, but then those loans lost value due to the interest rate movements. So effectively, you've got this high quality portfolio that JP Morgan's bought for not very much at all, underwritten by the FDIC, which is effectively a government agency. So once again, you can see how these large international banks really are calling the shots and how they are very much cooperating and working with the regulatory authorities. So when you come to things like transparency, openness, and what's really going on, the question is, how much of it really do we see and how much of it is just kept below the waterline? And remember, of course, that the Federal Reserve is essentially owned directly or indirectly by those large banks anyway.
So, and you're saying that First Republic was basically using home loans. That's how it was making its money, through the home loan market. So, and that's not always the case, is it, for US financial institutions, but certainly the case for Australia's major banks. So is that a warning to us too, particularly as we've had 11 interest rate increases? Is that going to put pressure on our banking sector too? It just can't afford to have a crash in the property market.
Of course, yes. Our banking in Australia, our banks are basically big building societies. The predominance of their book in terms of mortgages is unheard of relative to the rest of the world. So yes, our banks are highly leveraged into the property market, highly leveraged into the mortgage books. And if we start seeing unemployment rising and defaults rising, then that's going to put huge pressure on the banks. And interestingly, there's been a lot of talk recently about financial stability and the importance of financial stability, particularly from APRA. And what that basically means is if the banks start getting into difficulty, because the mortgage books get into crunch territory, we're going to see some unnatural acts. We're going to see banks, for example, extending the terms of the loans, forgiving interest rate in the short term, interest rate payments in the short term, all of those things, because nobody can allow the mortgage books to go bad, because if they did, then our financial system in Australia would fall apart. So we are skating on the edge of a very, very significant problem at the moment. And every time the RBA lifts rates higher, it increases the potential for risks to break out. Nobody quite knows when and how quickly. And of course, everybody says, well, everything's fine. There's no real sign of stress and strain yet. But actually, if you look at the data that I see, households are really struggling at the moment. So yeah, I think banks are at risk. And I think the mortgage books is going to be the epicenter of the next financial crisis in Australia.
And the government keeps telling us that it's high immigration levels are the need for skills, the shortages in the market. We need skills in the labour market. But they never talk about we're actually addicted to the growth, aren't we, that comes from masses of immigration because it fuels a housing market. And because otherwise, as you say, the banks would end up in trouble. But that's something that we're not going to talk about. It's ultimately unsustainable, though, isn't it? There has to be a crunch somewhere along the line.
Well, 400,000 is the estimated number, and that's way higher than it should have been. The point is that at a growth level, if you measure gross GDP with increasing numbers, it always goes up. But you need to look at GDP per capita, in other words, per person. And that's been going backwards for a long, long time. So the unsustainable migration paths that we've got at the moment is just putting more pressure on our infrastructure, on housing. That's one of the reasons why the rental crisis is where it is. But it's not a long-term sustainable solution. It's just making Australia way more crowded and frankly making housing less affordable. But nobody wants to talk about that because everyone is just looking at the top line GDP number. If you measure the economy by GDP, it takes you into a bit of a cul-de-sac, and that cul-de-sac is ever more higher costs of housing, ever more mortgages, ever more people. It's not a good future.
We're talking to Martin North about the recent First Republic Bank collapse in the US. We're going to go to news and we'll be straight back to continue the conversation. You're listening to TNT Radio.
Check this out.
Now, TNT Radio News.
Can you say
news?
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. Israel has bombed the Aleppo International Airport in Syria, killing at least one soldier. Ukraine says it's holding off on its long-touted spring counterattack against Russia because it cannot move Western tanks through its muddy terrain. Another freight train has been derailed in Russia in the second attack of its kind in as many days. And Turkey Air says it's discovered a major oil field big enough to supply the country with all the oil it needs.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365. We never stop sifting fact from fiction, misinformation from the truth. From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
We're talking to Martin North about the state of global finance, and we're specifically focusing on Australia at the moment too. I would say this thing, this unsustainable population growth that Australia is locked into, particularly as it doesn't have a manufacturing base now, this is how the banks and the economy itself becomes profitable. But and each government keeps kicking the can down the road. We're going to cause a problem, aren't we? An intergenerational problem, because millennials and Zoomers in particular feel really locked out of the market, the great Australian dream that we all look forward to one day, working hard and owning our own quarter acre block, is just an impossibility for them, isn't it? And that's going to create cultural problems for us in the long run.
Well, yeah, one of the interesting things, if you look at real income growth over the last decade plus, and you look at it by different cohorts, so age groups, in fact, income has gone backwards the fastest for younger people. So if you're in the 20s or 30s or your 40s, your income has actually, in real terms, gone backwards faster than it ever has. If you're older, your income still has gone backwards, but not as much. So we already have a massive amount of pressure on younger households. And of course, a lot of those people will have significant hex debts because of the way that the education system works. So they start their life with bigger debts to start with. One of the other things we're seeing is that a lot of those people, if they do buy a property, are buying property a decade later than previously. So they're older when they finally get into the property market, have to spend a lot more, they have bigger mortgages, and that means that they have less disposable income for other things. So the decks are stacked against the younger generations. And the other point is a lot of the migrants that are being dragged into Australia at the moment are younger too. So in fact, it's the younger generations who are actually going to be competing with those migrants who are coming into the country as well. So the decks are stacked against the younger cohorts. And, you know, the question is, will people just say, oh, well, you know, that's the way it is and just carry on? Or will this become a tipping point? Will it actually start then raising, you know, big questions, both political questions, economic questions, and maybe even social questions? Because, frankly, I think youngsters are being handed a very, very bad hand of cards at the moment.
Yeah, so this is a real weakness in globalization, isn't it? And this is why they're sort of tightening up on so many of their controls, with attacks on free speech, et cetera, because it can't afford ultimately to have this criticism because it doesn't know what to do about itself. And I guess, too, you can understand with 8 billion people on the planet and counting, it's going to be a concern, a social concern moving forward, isn't it?
Well, it is. And interestingly, most Western economies are desperately trying to attract more migrants. It's happening in the UK, it's happening in New Zealand, it's happening in the US and Canada. Everybody's wanting more migrants because it's the numbers game. But, you know, is it sustainable? What's going on? I don't think it is. And if you're somebody who is saving for a house and you're watching the property prices still, you know, drift sideways or maybe up in some cases, lending is tighter than it ever was, so it's harder to get that loan in the first place. So your whole aspiration set is changing. And the other point, of course, is that there's more insecure work and there's more part-time work and there's more, you know, wobbly structures around working as well. So, yeah, whichever way you look at it, I think we've lost the plot, really, in terms of building a sustainable long-term strategy for society. But then politicians really are only interested in the next 1 to 2 to 3 years, right, around the election cycle. And so they don't really want to tackle some of those structural difficult problems. You know, this housing thing is going wrong for 30 years, and you know, the banking system has been wobbly for 20 to 30 years, but nobody wants to tackle these big issues. Everybody wants to deflect and, you know, talk about some of the other stuff that's, you know, important, but not necessarily critical. And as a result of that, I think that we are seeing societal risk at the moment of breakdown, and that's a real problem.
We were told, weren't we, not to populate as much as our, you know, even my grandfather's generation. He was one of 13. You know, I was one of two, and that's true across the board. So many people would say the same thing, but the population growth was still really real in Africa, say, for example, and China, and they're trying to address that now. And India has just become the most populous nation in the world. But it's really richness to take the you know, migrants from Africa, take the young and best and brightest, because we need skills. We've got skills shortages, and we talk about equality, but at the same time, we're leaving those people left in those countries to a life without their best and brightest. So there will be no equality for them moving forward. They never even hope to bring themselves out of the poverty that so many of them currently endure.
Well, that's right. And in fact, if you think of things like, you know, doctors and nurses and, you know, bringing those in from other countries where they've been trained, for example, or even the, you know, the construction industry are talking about bringing builders in from other countries. And what you're actually doing is you're actually depleting those very countries who've perhaps spent time and effort trying to actually build the skills locally. And then they come to places like Australia or New Zealand. And so there's this really significant level of inequality, because what we're not doing is we're not investing sufficiently in our own, you know, education systems and community systems here. What we're doing is allowing other people to do the heavy lifting, and then we just, you know, bring them into Australia. I mean, this is a, you know, it's a really deep structural issue. It's a global issue. But again, I'm not sure that's one that people really want to talk about.
I don't think people would even know what to do about it. How do we stop our young folk then? You know, I've got children. How do we, in the face of this, and they feel these challenges, they see these challenges, they grow up with the stories of how I grew up and how their grandparents grew up, and they know how different it was. How do we stop them from actually becoming dispirited to the point of actually even maybe becoming dangerous themselves?
Well, I think if you watch carefully, there are people leaving Australia even now, going to some other countries where, in fact, maybe, you know, they see that the grass could be greener. But whether it's true or not is another question, of course. But yeah, it's a really difficult question. And the point I'd make also is that a lot of particularly younger people, are really skeptical about politics and politicians and, you know, what goes on. So if you don't believe that the political system is able to effectively address those issues, and frankly, you know, even if you go to the ballot box, does it make a difference, because both sides of politics tend to actually have the same policies? What does that tell you about democracy and how democracy is going to play out? And, you know, could democracy break?
Do people even believe in that term anymore when they hear it and they see how it plays out in reality? Do they even believe there is such a thing as a democratic process, or is it just a uniparty state?
Well, I think the problem is that pretty much all of the political parties have the same, you know, neoliberal ideological set of values. There's very little difference, you know, whether it's one side of politics, the other, you know, big business, big banks, etc. That's where all the power lays. So in a way, the political system and democratic system is really pretty much messed up at the moment, and not just here in Australia, but I think in other places too. And that doesn't bode well, I think, for the future, because of course then what you do is you start getting polarized reactions, you know, left wing, right wing, people who actually want to be disruptive. And that doesn't necessarily lead us to a good outcome either. So, I mean, there are significant risks here in terms of the future of the way that society is going. And it's all because of the fact that the people who are in charge today aren't willing and able to really step up and do the things that they know they should be doing, but it's politically difficult to do, so they just do the easy things.
Is this potential for disruption actually perfect for institutionalization of central banking digital currency, for a CBDC?
Well, you know, the fact is that central banks, who, you know, look at the review of the RBA, one of the recommendations was that the Treasury shouldn't be able to intervene with central bank policy at all in Australia. Those central bankers, unelected, are calling the shots more and more. You know, politicians step back rather than step forward. And the central bank digital currency is the final nail in the coffin, because basically that will give them total control of the payment system, the financial system, and, you know, they'll be able to pull their levers and give them, quote, more levers to implement their monetary policies. This is a very undemocratic thing that's going on. And again, it's something which we're not talking sufficiently about, because once you've actually got control of the financial system and the payment system in particular, and if you put it into the context of things like digital ID and all of those things, you know, if you don't do the right thing, say the right thing, suddenly your financial position might be worse than you thought it was. Who's holding the cards? Who's accountable for that? And remember that central bankers are not elected.
Martin North, thanks so much for joining me on the Damien Richardson Show.
Good to talk to you.
You're listening to TNT Radio.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
You know, the more I look into CO2, the more I realize that all this demonizing of CO2 is simply what we see today. Up is down, down is up, back is forth, forth is back. Everything is opposite. It's like a Seinfeld episode. Remember the Bizarro World Seinfeld episode? Or what was the one where George was just doing everything opposite of what he thought he should do? Well, that's what this is all about. I want you to listen to this, okay? If CO2 is toxic, then why the space station and submarine operator still alive? This is from a guy named John Shuchuk, who I follow on Twitter. 415 parts per million. That's the current CO2 level. 900 parts per million is when primates develop. 1,000, common in commercial airplanes. 1,200 is common in greenhouses. That's parts per million. That's why plants grow faster in greenhouses. 2,000 parts per million, dinosaurs thrive. 4,000 parts per million, that's what's in the space vehicle. 7,000 parts per million, that's what we get in submarines. 10,000 parts per million, common in motorcycle helmets. And human breath, 40,000 parts per million. Now think about that next time you're in an enclosed stadium enjoying a sport. All that carbon dioxide! Yet you seem to survive, unless of course your team actually doesn't win. This is TNT climate and weather watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
This is 5.5 liters of liquid. Now, if you remove a pint, here it is again. Did you notice the difference? Of course not. There's 5.5 litres of blood in the human body. By donating a pint, you'll save up to 3 lives. Give what you can go without to those who can't live without. To start saving lives today, Google your nearest donor centre.
Our liberty depends on the freedom of the press, and that cannot be limited without being lost. Lighting the fuse for freedom, TNT Radio.
Now, my next guest is a colleague. As a matter of fact, he's got his own show, of course, on TNT Radio called Locked and Loaded, where he serves up a diet of current affairs and a healthy dose with, you know, a bit of salt and light, promoting truth and exposing lies, both global and local. And he's highlighting and discussing issues mainstream media, obviously, paid shills to ignore. Rick Munn, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Damien. It's good to speak with you.
It's great to have you, my friend. Now, I can detect a bit of Celtic heritage there, like myself. Ireland is about to pass, like, it's these incredible radical hate speech laws that's people will be put in jail simply for possessing material that's deemed hateful by who knows, and you might be able to enlighten us on that. Just even if it's just on their device, so if you've just simply looked at it, it'll be enough. And you're going to be guilty until proven innocent. What's going on in Ireland, Rick?
Well, what's not going on in Ireland might be the better question. Everything's going on here to destroy the country, to destroy its future, to destroy any heritage that we currently have or will have going down the line. And one of the things that's being brought in to do that is this Hate Speech Act that is currently going through the Irish Parliament. Now, there's a lot of talk about this. Some chap from Ireland, a fellow called Keith Woods, tweeted about this last week, and it seems to have exploded. A lot of heads are jumping on the bandwagon. Elon Musk has weighed in. One of the Trumps has weighed in. Everybody seems to be talking about this except the politicians in Ireland. Okay, so it's reached far and wide because of what it is. And it's basically an inversion of everything that's good and right to do with free speech and to do with your own human rights. They're trying to overturn them. Just in a nutshell, Damien, this chap has written a tweet, and I'll just paraphrase it here. Ireland's about to pass one of the most radical hate speech bills yet, says Irish nationalist Keith Woods. Merely possessing hateful, in inverted commas, material on your devices is enough to face prison time. Not only that, but the burden of proof is shifted to the accused, who's expected to prove that they didn't intend to use it to spread hate, again, in inverted commas. This cause is so radical that even the Trotskyist People Before Profit Party in Ireland opposed it as a flagrant violation of civil liberties, dark times. So if this goes through, technically speaking, you or I, if we were in Ireland or a resident there, could be fined or imprisoned for even having a meme saved on your phone that you didn't send to anybody, you weren't going to show anybody, but you have to prove that you weren't going to use it to spread and incite hate. So it's thought crime. It's like they're trying to bring Minority Report to life in Ireland.
Yeah, I'm aware of Keith Woods, and it's ultimately an attack on people like him. And I was talking to my last guest before too. There's a younger generation that are really concerned with ethnic nationalism that no one wants to talk about because it's too frightening, it's too threatening. And it's people like Keith Woods. He's got a huge following. He was banned from Twitter. Elon Musk let him back on Twitter, and suddenly he was just getting thousands and thousands and thousands of more followers because people are really interested in this message. Now, there's people really starting to fight back against busloads of immigrants that are coming into Ireland, and there's real pushback. Now, you won't see it on the mainstream media. You have to go to, you know, alternative channels to see it's actually even occurring. But it is occurring, and it's threatening. And this is exactly who these laws are intended to capture, isn't it? The so-called, you know, white domestic terrorist or traditional heritage Irish men and women.
Yeah, exactly. And the racist word is one that is just being spammed relentlessly over here. If you are a dissenting voice against the government's plantation of Ireland policy, which basically means to bring huge amounts of people in from other places, most of whom are young men, unvetted, impossible to prove they are who they say they are, and put them in hotels, modular homes, converted sports centres in Irish towns and cities, destroying the tourist industry, causing a lot of friction and tension. Well, you know, I would, if I brought that up as a concern to my local MP or stood in my local public square and voiced my opinion, I could be labelled a right-wing extremist, a racist, a xenophobe, etc. I'm not. I'm just concerned about A, the safety of the people in the vicinity around me, and B, the future of my country. So I'm all for people coming into Ireland from overseas. I'm all for helping people that are in need, but we need to know who the people are, and we need to know what the long-term plan is for them, and we need not to be labelled racists, xenophobes, and extreme fascists just simply for bringing the question up to our local members of Parliament. And that's unfortunately the position we're in now, and one of the reasons they're pushing this bill through is to silence people like me or anybody else that brings this matter up in Ireland and potentially throw them into jail. It's Orwellian to the max.
And people like Keith Woods, though, would say it's actually demographic replacement that's being achieved here. Would you concur with that assessment? It's not just about helping people that are in need. It's actually about a structural shift in the nature of who, what it means to be Irish, which ultimately, and it's happening across many countries, will mean there'll be no such thing as national identity at all. Huh.
Correct. Well, that's effectively what's happening now. It's not just Ireland that this is happening in. It's really England's being plagued by this as well. And again, let me be clear, it's the illegality of this that's the main issue. For example, in England, there are tens of thousands of people crossing the English Channel every year who are unvetted. They're male. There's no women. There's no children, or very, very few at least. They're being assisted by the French Navy. They're being picked up by the Royal Navy and a charitable organisation called the RNLI, the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, and ferried across the English Channel, where they're picked up by the police, put on coaches, and taken to hotels, guest houses, B&Bs, or other places of occupation to do what? But many of them can't speak English. None of their identities, or many of their identities, can't be verified. So it's very hard to dissuade me from the point of view that there's something sinister going on here. And it's not for the benefit of Ireland or England, Scotland or Wales. That's a fact. And we're seeing this progress going from bad to worse on a monthly basis. So it's not heading the right way, Damien.
I've been talking to a woman on my show, which comes out of Victoria, Australia, and she's from Dorset, but she's gotten in touch with me because she doesn't know where else to go. And she thought, well, I'll be someone that would actually hear her voice. And she was right, as it turns out, but she's talking about exactly the same thing in Dorset. At the moment, there's it's been passed that 500 of these men, all men, young fighting age men, will be housed in a barge off the coast of Dorset. And she's the lone voice trying to resist it, trying to even just bring it to an attention that actually there may be a problem here, especially because they've part of the deal that they'll be on this barge is that they can come and go independently as they please, because anything else would be oppressive to their human rights. But she can't get any traction.
No, well, that barge story as well, I mean, like that barge, I don't know if you know this or not, but it was being taken from Italy and sealed all the way from Italy to be moored up in the UK, if this is the same one that we're thinking about. I covered this a few weeks ago. But the problem is there's at least 500 people a day piling into the UK. So technically speaking, if you were to use barges to solve this solution, you'd need to be commissioning one of these barges every single day and mooring it up somewhere just to take in the amount of people that are landing on the shores in South England. So it's I don't know, you know, where the thinking was in this. Was it a sensationalist story? It's real. They're actually doing it, but it's like putting a band-aid or a sticking plaster over a severed limb. It's not really going to do anything to stem the flow of blood or to help the cause at all, but it looks like you're seen to be doing something, even though what you're doing is completely ineffective. And again, another waste of taxpayers' money. They're spending thousands every day mooring that barge, and then they have to hire that barge, and then the cost of shipping that barge over, policing that barge, putting security in there, putting medical facilities in there, and feeding and housing the men that are in there. It's insane, Damien, what's going on.
And who's at home protecting the women? That's what I think. Who's at home protecting the women where these men are from?
Well, Well, this is it. And that's another question that when you bring it up, you know, you're told you're not understanding, you're not compassionate. But when I see a man, just one man, you could say, well, maybe he's a single guy, maybe his family have been killed. But if I see 50 guys landing in my town and there's, you know,
they're like 18
and yeah, or 500 for that matter, between 18 and 50 years of age, and I'm told they're fleeing from persecution or they're fleeing from death or whatever it happens to be, the first thing I'd say is, where's their wives, their mothers, their brothers, their sisters, their fathers, and their extended family? Is it just the men that ran off? And, you know, we're told, well, they're going to make a new start, and then when it's ready, then they'll bring the family over. I would have thought you'd have sent your family over. I think you're a family man, and so am I. If I was under threat of death here, I would make sure I was the last person to leave Ireland rather than the first leaving my wife and daughter behind. If you're any kind of man, you would make sure your wives and children are looked after first, I would have thought.
If anyone was in any doubt that we're living in a new reality now, these very laws you're talking about have been passed in Ireland would have made it illegal, wouldn't they, for Sinn Féin's political resistance to British colonial rule? Because don't tell me Sinn Féin wouldn't have had a few, you know, depictions of the British colonialists that were less than flattering on, you know, at least, I mean, obviously maybe not computers. Well, yeah, even that age, there still would have been computer-generated material. So this would make that actually that act of resistance illegal.
They're all on the payroll, Damien. There is no political opposition of any shape and form anywhere anymore. So in Ireland, for example, just to follow up from the original message that Keith Woods put out, there was, to give you an indicator, only 12 members of parliament voted against this bill, only 12, and 36 of them weren't even in the parliament whenever the bill was actually being debated. So one party, for example, was called People Before Profit. It's a small party. They tried to put two amendments in, one to include the United Nations Convention on Human Rights Protections and Freedom of Speech. It was rejected. The other one was to remove the section allowing for the prosecution of individuals possessing material without actually communicating it. And it was also removed as well. So they're actually removing UN conventions on human rights from that bill and rejecting them outright. So it makes you ask the question, are these human rights that we possess, these constitutions that are in place in our countries that people swear by and live by and die by, are they actually worth anything? Are they just words on pieces of paper if they can't actually be enacted to protect the people in the countries in which they live?
So Rick, this is happening across the world, as you say, and I don't know if you're aware, but at the moment there's before the US courts this protection in 1996, part of the US Communications Decency Act, Section 230 states that no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. So that's basically if I put something on, you know, on a service that you had provided, you are not held liable for that under free speech. You'd say, well, you know, that's Damien's hatred or whatever. That's not what Rick Munns thinks. Obviously protects, you know, services like Instagram and Twitter and the rest of it. But they're trying to change that so people would be held to account. So publishers like that would be held to account, but they're not even saying they're publishers, they're just service providers. So again, that's just going to erode free speech as well. So the system is really showing its teeth, it's baring its teeth. In the process of baring its teeth, it's showing how dangerously weak it actually is because it cannot handle any legitimate criticism.
Exactly. And Damien, let me ask you a question. How do you prove that something that you hold on your phone that is just simply on your phone, you haven't sent it to anyone, you're not intending to spread it, how do you prove that you're not going to send that to anybody? That's what the onus of proof is will be on Irish people going forward if this thing takes root. So rather than, you know, innocent until proven guilty, you will now be guilty until you can prove yourself innocent that you weren't going to spread something that someone else might be offended by. According to the arbiters of morality in Ireland, you have to prove that you weren't going to spread that or disseminate that, or else you'll face time in prison. How can you prove you're not going to do something? You can only prove if somebody has done something. You can't prove that they're not.
It just turns the English common law, something that we've been so proud of in the West, or the parts of the West that actually have common law, it just turns it on its head. Go on.
It's inversion. It's just another example of inversion. Everything is inverted in this world right now. Good is inverted to become evil. Evil has been inverted to become good. The left and the right don't know which side they're on anymore. Everything is just upside down, back to front and inside out. And unfortunately, this story that we're talking about here, along with other issues, is just another example of societal inversion, an inversion of common sense and all things good and proper. And it just seems to be par for the course. That's the world in which we live right now. It's just the lunatics are well and truly in control of the asylum.
Rick, you know, it's going to be a hard news break in a minute, so I'm going to have to go, but I just wanted to ask you this, because this is just insane. Like, they're saying it's an offence to prepare or possess material likely to incite violence or hatred against persons on account of their protected characteristics. Well, who decides who those characteristics are? It's correct. Certainly not the characteristics of saying someone's a woman, because you're not allowed to say that's not a protected characteristic anymore. So what does that even mean?
Exactly. Who are they? You know, whenever we're talking, a lot of times we talk about they, you know, they want to do this, they want to do that. The problem is there is no face to put with the theys. Okay. So it's this faceless body of, moral crusaders that decide what is right and wrong. The thought police, if you will, and the thought police don't have faces. Unfortunately, they're just they.
Rick Munn from Locked and Loaded, thanks so much for joining me on the Damien Richardson Show. It's been a good chat. We'll have to get you back so we can continue this conversation.
You're welcome. Have a good one, Damien.
Thanks, brother. Look, this is serious consequences too, because people face, you know, for a summary conviction, which is a crime that's not as bad, a lesser crime, they can go to jail for 6 months. Or a fine, or both. But for a conviction of an indictment offence of possessing materials that's classified as contraband, according to, well, who knows, the arbiters of that are, they would go to prison and get a fine not exceeding 2 years. You're listening to TNT Radio.